She touched his face and then took her hand back. She understood he wanted to be by himself for a while, to not have to talk or share his worry for a time. She picked up her purse from the nightstand, and he helped her into her coat. "I won't be gone long," she said.
"Just sit and rest for a while when you get home," he said. "Eat something. After you get out of the bath, just sit for a while and rest. It'll do you a world of good, you'll see. Then come back down here," he said. "Let's try not to worry ourselves sick. You heard what Dr. Francis said."
She stood in her coat for a minute, trying to recall the doctor's exact words, looking for any nuances, any hint of something behind his words, other than what he was saying. She tried to remember if his expression had changed any when he bent over to examine Scotty. She remembered the way his features had composed themselves as he rolled back the boy's eyelids and then listened to his breathing. She went to the door and turned and looked back. She looked at the boy, and then she looked at the father. Howard nodded. She stepped out of the room and pulled the door closed behind her. She went past the nurse's station and down to the end of the corridor, looking for the elevator. At the end of the corridor, she turned to her right, where she found a little waiting room with a Negro family sitting in wicker chairs. There was a middle-aged man in a khaki shirt and pants, a baseball cap pushed back on his head. A large woman wearing a house dress and slippers was slumped in one of the chairs. A teenaged girl in jeans, hair done in dozens of little braids, lay stretched out in one of the chairs smoking a cigarette, legs crossed at the ankles. The family swung their eyes to her as she entered the room. The little table was littered with hamburger wrappers and styrofoam cups.
"Nelson?" the large woman said as she roused herself. "Is about Nelson?"
Her eyes widened.
"Tell me now, lady," the woman said. "Is about Nelson?"
She was trying to rise from her chair, but the man had closed his hand over her arm.
"Here, here," he said. "Evelyn."
"I'm sorry," Anne said. "I'm looking for the elevator. My son is in the hospital, and now I can't find the elevator."
"Elevator is down that way. Turn left," the man said and aimed a finger down another corridor.
The girl drew on her cigarette and stared at Anne. Her eyes were narrowed to slits, and her broad lips parted slowly as she let the smoke escape. The Negro woman let her head fall down on her shoulder and looked away from Anne, no longer interested. "My son was hit by a car," Anne said to the man. She seemed to need to explain herself. "He has a concussion and a little skull fracture, but he's going to be all right. He's in shock now, but it might be some kind of coma, too. That's what really worries us, the coma part. I'm going out for a little while, but my husband is with him. Maybe he'll wake up while I'm gone."
"That's too bad," the man said and shifted in the chair.
He shook his head. He looked down at the table, and then he looked back at Anne. She was still standing there. He said,
"Ah, Nelson. He's on the operating table. Somebody cut him, tried to kill him. There was a fight where he was at this party. They say he was just standing and watching, not bothering nobody. But that don't mean nothing these days. Now he's on the operating table. We're just hoping and praying, that's all we can do now."
He gazed at her steadily and then tugged the bill of his cap. Anne looked at the girl again, who was still watching her, and at the older woman who kept her head down on her shoulder but whose eyes were now closed. Anne saw the lips moving silently, making words. She had an urge to ask what those words were. She wanted to talk more with these people who were in the same kind of waiting she was in. She was afraid, and they were afraid. They had that in common. She would have liked to have said something else about the accident, told them more about Scotty, that it had happened on the day of his birthday, Monday, that he was still unconscious. Yet she didn't know how to begin, and so only stood there looking at them without saying anything more. She went down the corridor the man had indicated and found the elevator. She stood for a minute in front of the closed doors, still wondering if she was doing the right thing. Then she put out her finger and touched the button. She pulled into the driveway and cut the engine. Slug ran around from behind the house.
In his excitement, he began to bark at the car, then ran in circles on the grass. She closed her eyes and leaned her head against the wheel for a minute. She listened to the ticking sounds the engine made as it began to cool. Then she got out of the car. She picked up the little dog, Scotty's dog, and went to the front door, which was unlocked. She turned on lights and put on a kettle of water for tea. She opened some dog food and fed Slug on the back porch. He ate in hungry little smacks between running back and forth to see that she was going to stay. As she sat down on the sofa with her tea, the telephone rang. "Yes," she said as she answered. "Hello."
"Mrs. Weiss,"
a man's voice said. It was 5 o'clock in the morning, and she thought she could hear machinery or equipment of some kind in the background. "Yes, yes, what is it?" she said carefully into the receiver. "This is Mrs. Weiss. This is she. What is it, please?" She listened to whatever it was in the background. "Is it Scotty, for Christ's sake?"
"Scotty," the man's voice said. "It's about Scotty, yes. It has to do with Scotty, that problem. Have you forgotten about Scotty?" the man said. Then he hung up.
She dialed the hospital's number and asked for the third floor. She demanded information about her son from the nurse who answered the telephone. Then she asked to speak to her husband. It was, she said, an emergency. She waited, turning the telephone cord in her fingers. She closed her eyes and felt sick at her stomach. She would have to make herself eat. Slug came in from the back porch and lay down near her feet. He wagged his tail. She pulled his ear while he licked her fingers. Howard was on the line. "Somebody just called here," she said. She twisted the telephone cord and it kinked back into itself. He said it was about Scotty," she cried.
"Scotty's fine," Howard was telling her. "I mean, he's still sleeping. There's been no change. The nurse has been in twice since you've been gone. They're in here every 30 minutes or so. A nurse or a doctor, one. He's all right, Anne."
"Somebody called. He said it was about Scotty," she said.
"Honey, you rest for a little while. You need the rest. Then come back down here. It must be that same caller I had. Just forget it. Come back down here after you've rested. Then we'll have breakfast or something."
"Breakfast," she said. "I couldn't eat anything."
"You know what I mean," he said. "Juice, a muffin, something, I don't know. I don't know anything, Anne. Jesus, I'm not hungry either. Anne, it's hard to talk now. I'm standing here at the desk. Dr. Francis is coming again at 8 o'clock this morning. He's going to have something to tell us then, something more definite. That's what one of the nurses said. She didn't know any more than that. Anne?" "Honey, maybe we'll know something more then, at 8 o'clock. Come back here before 8. Meanwhile, I'm right here and Scotty's all right. He's still the same," he added.
"I was drinking a cup of tea," she said, "when the telephone rang. They said it was about Scotty. There was a noise in the background. Was there a noise in the background on that call you had, Howard?"
"I honestly don't remember," he said. "It must have been a drunk or somebody calling, though God knows I don't understand. Maybe the driver of the car, maybe he's a psychopath and found out about Scotty somehow. But I'm here with him. Just rest a little like you were going to do. Take a bath and come back here by 7 or so, and we'll talk to the doctor together when he gets here. It's going to be all right, honey. I'm here and there are doctors and nurses around. They say his condition is stable."
"I'm scared to death," she said. She ran water, undressed, and got into the tub. She washed and dried quickly, not taking the time to wash her hair. She put on clean underwear, wool slacks, and a sweater. She went into the living room where Slug looked up at her and let his tail thump once against the floor. It was just starting to get light outside when she went out to the car. Driving back to the hospital on the damp, deserted streets, she thought back to the rainy Sunday afternoon nearly 2 years ago when Scotty had been lost and they'd been afraid he'd drowned. The sky had darkened that afternoon, and rain had begun to fall, and still he hadn't come home. They'd called all his friends who were at home and safe.
She and Howard had gone to look for him at his board and rock fort at the far end of the field near the highway, but he wasn't there. Then Howard had run in one direction beside the highway, and she had run the other way until she came to what had once been a little stream of water, a drainage ditch. But its banks were filled now with a dark torrent. One of his friends had been with him there when the rain started. They had been making boats out of pieces of scrap wood and empty beer cans that had been tossed from passing cars. They had been lining up the beer cans on the pieces of wood and sending them out into the stream. The stream ended on this side of the highway at a culvert where the water boiled and could take anything under and into the pipe. The friend had left Scotty there on the bank when the first drops of rain had begun to fall. Scotty had said he was going to stay and build a bigger boat. She had stood on the bank and gazed into the water as it poured into the mouth of the culvert and disappeared under the highway. It was plain to her what must have happened, that he had fallen in, that he must even now be lodged somewhere inside the culvert. The thought was monstrous, so unfair and overwhelming that she couldn't hold it in her mind. But she felt it was true, that he was in there, in the culvert, and knew, too, it was something that would have to be born and lived with from here on, a life without Scotty in it. But how to act in the face of this, the fact of the loss, was more than she could comprehend. The horror of the men and equipment working at the mouth of the culvert through the night, that was what she did not know if she could endure, that waiting while the men worked under powerful lights. She would have to somehow get past that to the limitless sweep of emptiness she knew stretched beyond. She was ashamed to know it, but she thought she could live with that. Later, much later, maybe then she would be able to come to terms with that emptiness. After the presence of Scotty had gone out of their lives, then perhaps she would learn to handle that loss and the awful absence. She would have to, that's all. But now she did not know how she could get through the waiting part to that other part. She dropped to her knees. She stared into the current and said that if he would let them have Scotty back, if he could have somehow miraculously, she said it out loud, miraculously, escaped the water and the culvert, she knew he hadn't, but if he had, if he could only let them have Scotty back, somehow not let him be wedged in the culvert, she promised then that she and Howard would change their lives, change everything, go back to the small town where they had come from, away from this suburban place that could ruthlessly snatch away your only child. She had still been on her knees when she heard Howard calling her name from across the field through the rain. She had raised her eyes and seen them coming toward her, the two of them, Howard and Scotty.
He was hiding,
Howard said, laughing and crying at once.
I was so glad to see him, I couldn't begin to punish him. He'd made a shelter. He'd fixed himself up a place under the overpass in those bushes. He'd made like a nest for himself,
he said. The two of them were still coming toward her as she got to her feet. She doubled her fists.
Forts leak, the little nut said. He was dry as a bone when I found him, damn his hide,
Howard said, the tears breaking. Then Anne was on Scotty, slapping him on the head and face with a wild fury. You little devil, you, she shouted as she slapped him.
Anne, stop it, Howard said, grabbing for her arms. He's all right, that's the main thing, he's all right.
She'd picked the boy up while he was still crying and she'd held him. She'd held him. Their clothes soaked, shoes squishing with water, the three of them had begun to walk home. She carried the boy for a while, his arms around her neck, his chest heaving against her breasts. Howard walked beside them, saying,
Jesus, what a scare. God almighty, what a fright.
She knew Howard had been scared and was now relieved. But he hadn't glimpsed what she had. He couldn't know. The quickness of how she had gone into the death and beyond it had made her suspect herself that she hadn't loved enough. If she had, she would not have thought the worst so quickly. She shook her head back and forth at this craziness. She grew tired and had to stop and put Scotty down. They walked the rest of the way together, Scotty in the middle, holding hands, the three of them walking home. But they hadn't moved away,
and they'd never talked about that afternoon again. From time to time, she'd thought about her promise, the prayers she'd offered up, and for a while, she'd felt vaguely uneasy. But they had continued to live as they had been living, a comfortably busy life, not a bad or a dishonest life, a life, in fact, with many satisfactions and small pleasures. Nothing more was ever said about that afternoon, and in time, she had stopped thinking about it. Now, here, they were still in the same city, and it was 2 years later, and Scotty was again in peril, an awful peril, and she began to see this circumstance, this accident, and the not waking up as punishment. For hadn't she given her word that they'd move away from this city and go back to where they could live a simpler and quieter life, forget the jump in salary and the house, which was still so new they hadn't put up the fence or planted grass yet? She imagined them all sitting around each evening in some big living room in some other town and listening to Howard read to them. She drove into the parking lot of the hospital and found a space close to the front door. She felt no inclination to pray now. She felt like a liar caught out, guilty and false, as if she were somehow responsible for what had now happened. She felt she was, in some obscure way, responsible. She let her thoughts move to the Negro family, and she remembered the name Nelson and the table that was covered with hamburger papers and the teenaged girl staring at her as she drew on her cigarette. "Don't have children," she told the girl's image as she entered the front door of the hospital. "For God's sake, don't." She took the elevator up to the third floor with two nurses who were just going on duty. It was Wednesday morning, a few minutes before 7. There was a page for a Dr. Madison as the elevator doors slid open on the third floor. She got off behind the nurses, who turned in the other direction and continued the conversation she had interrupted when she'd gotten onto the elevator. She walked down the corridor to the little side room where the Negro family had been waiting. They were gone now, but the chairs were scattered in such a way that it looked as if people had just jumped from them the minute before. She thought the chairs might still be warm. The tabletop was cluttered with the same cups and papers, the ashtray filled with cigarette butts. She stopped at the nurse's station just down the corridor from the waiting room. A nurse was standing behind the counter, brushing her hair and yawning. "There was a Negro man in surgery last night," Anne said. "Nelson something was his name. His family was in the waiting room. I'd like to inquire about his condition." A nurse who was sitting at a desk behind the counter looked up from a chart in front of her. The telephone buzzed and she picked up the receiver, but she kept her eyes on Anne.
"He passed away," said the nurse at the counter.
The nurse held the hairbrush and kept on looking at her.
"Are you a friend of the family or what?"
"I met the family last night," Anne said. "My own son is in the hospital. I guess he's in shock. We don't know for sure what's wrong. I just wondered about Mr. Nelson, that's all. Thank you." She went on down the corridor. Elevator doors the same color as the walls slid open, and a gaunt, bald man in white pants and white canvas shoes pulled a heavy cart off the elevator. She hadn't noticed these doors last night. The man wheeled the cart out into the corridor and stopped in front of the room nearest the elevator and consulted a clipboard. Then he reached down and slid a tray out of the cart, rapped lightly on the door, and entered the room. She could smell the unpleasant odors of warm food as she passed the cart. She hurried past the other station without looking at any of the nurses and pushed open the door to Scotty's room. Howard was standing at the window with his hands together behind his back. He turned around as she came in. "How is he?" she said. She went over to the bed. She dropped her purse on the floor beside the nightstand. She seemed to have been gone a long time. She touched the covers around Scotty's neck. "Howard?"
"Dr. Francis was here a little while ago," Howard said.
She looked at him closely and thought his shoulders were bunched a little.
"I thought he wasn't coming until 8 o'clock this morning," she said quickly.
"There was another doctor with him, a neurologist."
"A neurologist," she said. Howard nodded. His shoulders were bunching. She could see that.
"What'd they say, Howard? For Christ's sake, what'd they say? What is it?"
They said, well, they're going to take him down and run more tests on him, Anne.
They think they're going to operate, honey.
Honey, they are going to operate. They can't figure out why he won't wake up. It's more than just shock or concussion, they know that much now. It's in his skull, the fracture, it has something to do with that, they think. So they're going to operate. I tried to call you, but I guess you'd already left the house.
Oh, God, she said. Oh, please, Howard, please,
she said, taking his arms.
Look, Howard said then. Scotty, look, Anne.
He turned her toward the bed. The boy had opened his eyes, then closed them. He opened them again now. The eyes stared straight ahead for a minute, then moved slowly in his head until they rested on Howard and Anne, then traveled away again.
Scotty, his mother said, moving to the bed.
Hey, Scott, his father said. Hey, son.
They leaned over the bed. Howard took Scotty's left hand in his hands and began to pat and squeeze the hand. Anne bent over the boy and kissed his forehead again and again. She put her hands on either side of his face.
Scotty, honey, it's Mommy and Daddy, she said. Scotty?
The boy looked at them again, though without any sign of recognition or comprehension. Then his eyes scrunched closed, his mouth opened, and he howled until he had no more air in his lungs. His face seemed to relax and soften then. His lips parted as his last breath was puffed through his throat and exhaled gently through the clenched teeth. The doctors called it a hidden occlusion and said it was a one-in-a-million circumstance. Maybe if it could have been detected somehow and surgery undertaken immediately, it could have saved him, but more than likely not. In any case, what would they have been looking for? Nothing had shown up in the tests or in the x-rays. Dr. Francis was shaken.
I can't tell you how badly I feel. I'm so very sorry I can't tell you,
he said as he led them into the doctor's lounge. There was a doctor sitting in a chair with his legs hooked over the back of another chair, watching an early morning TV show. He was wearing a green delivery room outfit, loose green pants and green blouse, and a green cap that covered his hair. He looked at Howard and Anne, and then looked at Dr. Francis. He got to his feet and turned off the set and went out of the room. Dr. Francis guided Anne to the sofa, sat down beside her, and began to talk in a low, consoling voice. At one point, he leaned over and embraced her. She could feel his chest rising and falling evenly against her shoulder. She kept her eyes open and let him hold her. Howard went into the bathroom, but left the door open. After a violent fit of weeping, he ran water and washed his face. Then he came out and sat down at a little table that held a telephone. He looked at the telephone as though deciding what to do first. He made some calls. After a time, Dr. Francis used the telephone.
Is there anything else I can do for the moment?
He asked them. Howard shook his head. Anne stared at Dr. Francis as if unable to comprehend his words. The doctor walked them to the hospital's front door. People were entering and leaving the hospital. It was 11 o'clock in the morning. Anne was aware of how slowly, almost reluctantly, she moved her feet. It seemed to her that Dr. Francis was making them leave, when she somehow felt they should stay, when it would be more the right thing to do to stay. She gazed out into the parking lot and then looked back at the front of the hospital from the sidewalk. She began shaking her head.
No, no, she said. This isn't happening. I can't leave him here. No.
She heard herself and thought how unfair it was that the only words that came out were the sorts of words on the TV shows where people were stunned by violent or sudden deaths. She wanted her words to be her own.
No,
she said, and for some reason the memory of the Negro woman's head lolling on her shoulder came to her.
No,
she said again.
I'll be talking to you later in the day,
the doctor was saying to Howard.
There are still some things that have to be done. Things that have to be cleared up to our satisfaction. Some things that need explaining.
An autopsy, Howard said. Dr. Francis nodded.
I understand,
Howard said.
Oh, Jesus. No, I don't understand, doctor. I can't. I just can't.
Dr. Francis put his arm around Howard's shoulders.
I'm sorry. God, how I'm sorry.
Then he let go and held out his hand. Howard looked at the hand, and then he took it. Dr. Francis put his arms around Anne once more. He seemed full of some goodness she didn't understand. She let her head rest on his shoulder, but her eyes were open. She kept looking at the hospital. As they drove out of the parking lot, she looked back at the hospital once more. At home, she sat on the sofa with her hands in her coat pockets. Howard closed the door to Scotty's room. He got the coffee maker going, and then he found an empty box. He had thought to pick up some of Scotty's things, but instead he sat down beside her on the sofa, pushed the box to one side, and leaned forward, arms between his knees. He began to weep. She pulled his head over into her lap and patted his shoulder. He's gone, she said. She kept patting his shoulder. Over his sobs, she could hear the coffee maker hissing out in the kitchen. There, there, she said tenderly. Howard, he's gone. He's gone, and now we'll have to get used to that. To being alone. In a little while, Howard got up and began moving aimlessly around the room with the box, not putting anything into it, but collecting some things on the floor at one end of the sofa. She continued to sit with her hands in her pockets. Howard put the box down and brought coffee into the living room. Later, Anne made calls to relatives. After each call had been placed and the party had answered, Anne would blurt out a few words and cry for a minute. Then she would quietly explain, in a measured voice, what had happened and tell them about arrangements. Howard took the box out to the garage where he saw Scotty's bicycle. He dropped the box and sat down on the pavement beside the bicycle. He took hold of the bicycle awkwardly so that it leaned against his chest. He held it, the rubber pedal sticking into his chest and turning the wheel across his trouser leg a little way. Anne hung up the telephone after talking to her sister. She was looking up another number when the telephone rang. She picked it up on the first ring. Hello? She said, and again she heard something in the background, a humming noise. Hello? Hello? She said. For God's sake, she said, who is this? What is it you want? Say something.
You're Scotty. I got him ready for you, the man's voice said. Did you forget him?
You evil bastard, she shouted into the receiver. How can you do this, you evil son of a bitch?
Scotty, the man said. Have you forgotten about Scotty?
Then the man hung up on her. Howard heard the shouting and came in to find her with her head on her arms over the table weeping. He picked up the receiver and listened to the dial tone. Much later, just before midnight, after they had dealt with many things, the telephone rang again. You answer it, she said. Howard, it's him, I know. They were sitting at the kitchen table with coffee in front of them. Howard had a small glass of whiskey beside his cup. He answered on the third ring.
Hello, he said. Who is this? Hello, hello.
The line went dead.
He hung up,
Howard said.
Whoever it was.
It was him, she said. That bastard. I'd like to kill him, she said. I'd like to shoot him and watch him kick, she said.
Anne, my God, he said.
Could you hear anything, she said. In the background, a noise, machinery, something humming?
Nothing really. Nothing like that,
he said.
There wasn't much time. I think there was some radio music. Yes, there was a radio going, that's all I could tell. I don't know what in God's name is going on, he said.
She shook her head. If I could get my hands on him. It came to her then. She knew who it was. Scotty, the cake, the telephone number. She pushed the chair away from the table and got up. Drive me down to the shopping center, she said. Howard.
What are you saying?
The shopping center. I know who it is who's calling now. I know who it is. It's the baker, the son of a bitching baker, Howard. I had him bake a cake for Scotty's birthday. That's who's calling. That's who has the number and keeps calling us to harass us about that cake. The baker, that bastard.
They drove out to the shopping center. The sky was clear and stars were out. It was cold, and they ran the heater in the car. They parked in front of the bakery. All of the shops and stores were closed, but there were still cars at the far end of the lot in front of the twin cinemas. The bakery windows were dark, but when they looked through the glass, they could see a light in the back room and, now and then, a big man in an apron moving in and out of the white, even light. Through the glass, she could see the display cases and some little tables with chairs. She tried the door. She rapped on the glass. But if the baker heard them, he gave no sign. He didn't look in their direction. They drove around behind the bakery and parked. They got out of the car. There was a lighted window too high up for them to see inside. A sign near the back door said, "The Pantry Bakery, Special Orders." She could hear faintly a radio playing inside and something, an oven door, creaking as it was pulled down. She knocked on the door and waited. Then she knocked again, louder. The radio was turned down, and there was a scraping sound now, the distinct sound of something, a drawer, being pulled open and then closed. The door was unlocked and opened. The baker stood in the light and peered out at them.
"I'm closed for business," he said. "What do you want at this hour? It's midnight. Are you drunk or something?"
She stepped into the light that fell through the open door, and he blinked his heavy eyelids as he recognized her.
"It's you," he said.
"It's me," she said. "Scotty's mother. This is Scotty's father. We'd like to come in."
The baker said, "I'm busy now. I have work to do."
She had stepped inside the doorway anyway. Howard came in behind her. The baker had moved back. "It smells like a bakery in here. Doesn't it smell like a bakery in here, Howard?"
"What do you want?" the baker said. "Maybe you want your cake?" "That's it. You decided you wanted your cake. You did order a cake, didn't you?"
"You're pretty smart for a baker," she said. "Howard, this is the man who's been calling us. This is the baker man." She clenched her fists. She stared at him fiercely. There was a deep burning inside her, an anger that made her feel larger than herself, larger than either of these men.
"Just a minute here," the baker said. "You want to pick up your 3-day-old cake? That it? I don't want to argue with you, lady. There it sits over there, getting stale. I'll give it to you for half of what I quoted you. No, you want it, you can have it. It's no good to me, no good to anyone now. It cost me time and money to make that cake. If you want it, okay. If you don't, that's okay, too. Just forget it and go. I have to get back to work."
He looked at them and rolled his tongue behind his teeth. "More cakes." She knew she was in control of it, of what was increasing her. She was calm.
"Lady, I work 16 hours a day in this place to earn a living," the baker said.
He wiped his hands on his apron.
"I work night and day in here trying to make ends meet."
A look crossed Anne's face that made the baker move back and say,
"No trouble now."
He reached to the counter and picked up a rolling pin with his right hand and began to tap-tap it against the palm of his other hand.
"You want the cake or not? I have to get back to work. Bakers work at night,"
he said again. His eyes were small, mean-looking, she thought, nearly lost in the bristly flesh around his cheeks. His neck around the collar of his t-shirt was thick with fat. "We know bakers work at night," Anne said. "They make phone calls at night, too." "You bastard," she said. The baker continued to tap the rolling pin against his hand. He glanced at Howard.
"Careful, careful," he said to them.
"My boy's dead," she said with a cold, even finality. "He was hit by a car Monday afternoon. We've been waiting with him until he died, but of course you couldn't be expected to know that, could you?
Bakers can't know everything. Can they, Mr. Baker? But he's dead. Dead, you bastard.
Just as suddenly as it had welled in her, the anger dwindled, gave way to something else, a dizzy feeling of nausea. She leaned against the wooden table that was sprinkled with flour, put her hands over her face and began to cry, her shoulders rocking back and forth.
It isn't fair, she said. It isn't fair.
Howard put his hand at the small of her back and looked at the baker.
Shame on you, Howard said to him. Shame.
The baker put the rolling pin back on the counter. He undid his apron and threw it on the counter. He stood a minute looking at them with a dull, pained look. Then he pulled a chair out from under a card table that held papers and receipts, an adding machine, and a telephone directory.
Please sit down, he said. Let me get you a chair, he said to Howard. Sit down now, please.
The baker went into the front of the shop and returned with two little wrought iron chairs.
Please sit down, you people.
Anne wiped her eyes and looked at the baker.
I wanted to kill you, she said. I wanted you dead.
The baker had cleared a space for them at the table. He shoved the adding machine to one side, along with the stacks of notepaper and receipts. He pushed the telephone directory onto the floor where it landed with a thud. Howard and Anne sat down and pulled their chairs up to the table. The baker sat down too.
I don't blame you,
the baker said, putting his elbows on the table and shaking his head slowly.
First, let me say how sorry I am. God alone knows how sorry. Listen to me. I'm just a baker. I don't claim to be anything else. Maybe once, maybe years ago, I was a different kind of human being. I've forgotten, I don't know for sure. But I'm not any longer, if I ever was. Now I'm just a baker. That don't excuse my offense, I know. But I'm deeply sorry. I'm sorry for your son, and I'm sorry for my part in this.
Sweet, sweet Jesus, the baker said. He spread his hands out on the table and turned them over to reveal his palms.
I don't have any children myself, so I can only imagine what you must be feeling. All I can say to you now is that I'm sorry. Forgive me, if you can,
the baker said.
I'm not an evil man, I don't think. Not evil, like you said on the phone. You must understand that what it comes down to is I don't know how to act anymore, it would seem.
Please, the man said.
Let me ask you if you can find it in your hearts to forgive me.
It was warm in the bakery, and Howard stood up from the table and took off his coat. He helped Anne from her coat. The baker looked at them for a minute and then nodded and got up from the table. He went to the oven and turned off some switches. He found cups and poured them coffee from an electric coffee maker. He put a carton of cream on the table and a bowl of sugar.
You probably need to eat something, the baker said. I hope you'll eat some of my hot rolls. You have to eat and keep going. Eating is a small, good thing in a time like this, he said.
He served them warm cinnamon rolls just out of the oven, the icing still runny. He put butter on the table and knives to spread the butter. Then the baker sat down at the table with them. He waited. He waited until they each took a roll from the platter and began to eat.
It's good to eat something, he said, watching them. There's more. Eat up. Eat all you want. There's all the rolls in the world in here.
They ate rolls and drank coffee. Anne was suddenly hungry and the rolls were warm and sweet. She ate three of them, which pleased the baker. Then he began to talk. They listened carefully. Although they were tired and in anguish, they listened to what the baker had to say. They nodded when the baker began to speak of loneliness and the sense of doubt and limitation that had come to him in his middle years. He told them what it was like to be childless all these years, to repeat the days with the ovens endlessly full and endlessly empty, The party food, the celebrations he'd worked over, icing knuckle deep. The wedding couples stuck to each other's arms, hundreds of them, no, thousands by now. Birthdays, just the candles from all those cakes if you thought you could see them all burning at once. He had a necessary trade. He was a baker. He was glad not to be a florist. It was better to be feeding people, not giving them something that sat around for a while until it was thrown out. This was a better smell than flowers.
Here, smell this,
the baker said, breaking open a dark loaf.
It's a heavy bread, but rich.
They smelled it. Then he had them taste it. It had the taste of molasses and coarse grains. They listened to him. They ate what they could. They swallowed the dark bread. It was like daylight under the fluorescent trays of light. They talked on into the early morning, a high, pale cast of light in the windows, and they did not think of leaving. Tell the women we're going. Bill Jameson had always been close with Jerry Roberts. The two grew up in the South area, near the old fairgrounds, went through grade school and junior high together, and then on to Eisenhower, where they took as many of the same classes and teachers as they could manage, wore each other's shirts and sweaters and pegged pants, and dated or ganged the same girl, whichever came up as a matter of course. Summers, they took jobs together, swamping peaches, picking cherries, stringing hops, anything they could do that paid a little money to see them through to fall, something where they didn't have to worry about a boss breathing down their necks every 5 minutes. Jerry didn't like to be told what to do. Bill didn't mind. He liked it that Jerry was the sort of take-charge guy he was. The summer just before their senior year, they chipped in and bought a red 54 Plymouth for $325. Jerry would keep it a week at a time, then Bill. They were used to sharing things, and it worked out fine for a while. But Jerry got married before the end of the first semester, kept the car, and dropped out of school to go to work steady at Robbie's Market. That was the only time there was a strain in their relationship. Bill liked Carol Henderson. He'd known her a couple of years, almost as long as Jerry had. But after Jerry and she got married, things were just never the same between the two friends. He was over there a lot, especially at first. It made him feel older, having married friends, for lunch or dinner, or else late evenings to listen to Elvis Presley and Bill Haley and the Comets, and there were a couple of Fats Domino records he liked. But it always embarrassed him when Carol and Jerry started kissing and near making out in front of him. Sometimes he'd have to excuse himself and take a walk to DeZorn's service station to get some coke, because there was only the one bed in the apartment, a hideaway that let down right in the middle of the living room. Other times, Jerry and Carol would simply head off in a clumsy, leg-hugging walk to the bathroom, and Bill would move to the kitchen and pretend to busy himself looking in the cupboards and refrigerator, trying not to listen. So he stopped going over so much. And then June he graduated, took a job at the Darigold milk plant, and joined the National Guard. In a year, he had a milk route of his own and was going steady with Linda Wilson, a good, clean girl. He and Linda dropped in at the Roberts once a week or so, drank beer and listened to records. Carol and Linda got along fine. Bill was flattered when Carol said that, confidentially, she thought Linda was a real person. Jerry liked Linda, too. She's a great little chick, he told Bill. When Bill and Linda married, Jerry was best man, of course, and at the reception later at the Donnelly Hotel, it was a little like old times. Jerry and Bill cutting up together and linking arms and tossing off glasses of spiked punch. But once, in the midst of his happiness, Bill looked at Jerry and thought how much older he looked. A lot older than just 22. His hair was beginning to recede, just like his father's, and he was getting heavy around the hips. He and Carol had 2 kids, and she was pregnant again. He was still with Robbie's Market, though now an assistant manager. Jerry got drunk at the reception and flirted with both bridesmaids, then tried to start a fight with one of the ushers. Carol had to drive him home before he made a real scene. They saw each other every 2 or 3 weeks, sometimes oftener, depending on the weather. If the weather was good, like now, they might get together on Sunday at Jerry's, barbecue hot dogs or hamburgers, and turn all the kids loose in the wading pool Jerry had got for next to nothing from one of the women checkers at the store. Jerry had a comfortable house. He lived in the country on a hill overlooking the Natchez River. There were a half dozen other houses scattered around, but he was by himself, too. Compared to in town, anyway. He liked his friends to come to his place. It was just too much trouble getting all the kids washed, dressed, and into the car, a red 68 Chevy hardtop. He and Carol had four kids now, all girls, and Carol was pregnant again. They didn't think they'd have any more after this one. Carol and Linda were in the kitchen washing dishes and straightening up. It was around 3 in the afternoon. Jerry's four little girls were playing with Bill's two boys, down below the house near a corner of the fence. They had a big red plastic ball they kept throwing into the wading pool and, yelling, splashed after. Jerry and Bill sat in reclining lawn chairs on the patio, drinking beer. Bill had to do most of the talking, things about people they both knew, the power play going on at the Darigold head office in Portland, about a new four-door Pontiac Catalina he and Linda were thinking of buying. Jerry nodded now and then, but most of the time just stared at the clothesline or at the garage. Bill thought he must be depressed, but then he'd noticed Jerry had gotten deep the last year or so. Bill moved in his chair, lighted a cigarette, finally said,
"Anything wrong, man?"
Jerry finished his beer and then mashed the can. He shrugged.
"What say we get out for a while? Just drive around a little, stop off and have a beer. Jesus, a guy gets stale just sitting around all his Sundays." "Sounds good to me, sure. I'll tell the women we're going." "By ourselves, remember. By God, no family outing. Say we're going to have a beer or something. I'll wait for you in the car. Take my car."
They hadn't done anything together for a long while. They took the Natchez River Highway out to Glede, Jerry driving. The day was warm and sunny, and the air blew through the car and felt good on their necks and arms. Jerry was grinning.
"Where are we going?" Bill said.
He felt a whole lot better just seeing Jerry brighten up.
"What say we go out to old Riley's, shoot a little rotation?" "Fine with me. Hey, man, we haven't done anything like this in a long time. Guy's got to get out now and then or he gets stale. Know what I mean?"
He looked at Bill.
"Can't be all work and no play. You know what I mean."
Bill wasn't sure. He liked to get out with the guys from the plant for the Friday night bowling league, and he liked to stop off once or twice a week after work with Jack Broderick and have a few beers. But he liked being at home, too. No, he wouldn't say he felt stale exactly. He looked at his watch.
"Still standing," Jerry said, pulling up onto the gravel in front of the Glede Recreation Center. "Been by here now and then, you know, but I haven't been inside for a year or so. Just no time anymore."
He spat. They went inside, Bill holding the door for Jerry. Jerry punched him lightly in the stomach as he went by.
"Hey there. How you boys doing? I haven't seen you boys around in I don't know how long. Where you been keeping yourselves?"
Riley started around from behind the counter, grinning. He was a heavy, bald-headed man wearing a short-sleeved print shirt that hung outside his jeans.
"Ah, dry up, you old coot, and give us a couple of olies," Jerry said, winking at Bill. "How you been?" "Fine, fine, just fine. How you boys doing? Where you been keeping yourselves? You boys getting any on the side? Jerry, the last time I seen you, your old lady was 6 months pregnant."
Jerry stood a minute and blinked his eyes.
"How long's that been, Riley? Has it been that long?"
"How about the Oli?" Bill said. "Riley, you have one with us."
They took stools near the window. Jerry said,
"What kind of place is this, Riley, that don't have any girls on a Sunday afternoon?"
Riley laughed.
"I guess there just ain't enough to go around, boys."
They had 5 cans of beer each and took 2 hours to play 3 games of rotation and 2 games of snooker. Riley didn't have anything to do and came around from behind the counter and sat on a stool and talked and watched them play. Bill kept looking at his watch, then at Jerry. Finally, he said,
"You think we should be going now, Jerry? I mean, what do you think?"
"Yeah, okay. Let's finish this beer, then go."
In a little while, Jerry drained his can, mashed it, and then sat there on the stool a minute, turning the can in his hand.
"See you around, Riley." "You boys come back now, you hear? Take it easy."
Back on the highway, Jerry opened it up some. Little spurts of 85 and 90, but there were other cars, people returning from the parks and the mountains, and he mostly had to be satisfied with a quick pass now and then a slow creeping along at 50 with the rest. They'd just passed an old pickup loaded with furniture when they saw two girls on bicycles.
"Look at that," Jerry said, slowing. "I could do for some of that."
He drove on by, but both of them looked back. The girls saw them and laughed, kept pedaling along the shoulder of the road. Jerry drove another mile and then pulled off the road at a wide place.
"Let's go back. Let's try it."
"Jesus. Well, I don't know, man. We should be getting back. That stuff's too young anyway, huh?
Old enough to bleed, old enough to... You know that saying."
"Yeah, but I don't know."
"Christ's sake. We'll just have some fun with them. Give them a bad time."
"All right, sure."
He glanced at his watch and then at the sky.
"You do the talking."
"Me? I'm driving. You do the talking. Besides, they'll be on your side."
"I don't know, man. I'm rusty."
Jerry hooted as he whipped the car around, then started back the way they'd come. He slowed when he came nearly even with the girls, pulled onto the shoulder across from the road from them.
"Hey, where you going? Want a lift?"
The girls looked at each other and laughed, but kept riding. The girl on the inside, nearest the road, was 17 or 18, dark-haired, tall and willowy as she leaned over her bicycle. The other girl was the same age, but smaller and with light hair. They both wore shorts and halters.
"Bitches," Jerry said. "We'll get 'em, though."
He was waiting for the cars to pass so he could pull a U.
"I'll take the brunette, you take the little one, okay?"
Bill moved his back against the front seat and touched the bridge of his dark glasses.
"Hell, we're wasting our time anyway. They're not going to do anything."
"Christ, man. Jesus, don't go in there already defeated."
Bill lighted a cigarette. Jerry pulled across the road and, in a minute or two, drove up behind the girls.
"Okay, do your stuff," he said to Bill. "Turn on your charms now. Hustle them in for us."
"Hi,"
Bill said as they drove slowly alongside the girls.
"My name's Bill."
"That's nice," the brunette said. The other girl laughed, and then the brunette laughed too.
"Where are you going?"
The girls didn't answer. The little one tittered. They kept riding, and Jerry drove along slowly beside them.
"Oh, come on now. Where are you going?"
"No place," the little one answered.
"Where's no place?"
"Just no place."
"I told you my name. What's yours?" "This is Jerry."
The girls looked at each other and laughed again. They kept riding. A car came up from behind, and the driver leaned on the horn.
"Ah, cram it," Jerry said.
He pulled off a little farther onto the shoulder, though, and after a minute, seeing his chance, the driver of the other car shot around them. They pulled up alongside the girls again.
"Let us give you a lift," Bill said. "We'll take you wherever you want to go. That's a promise. You must be tired riding those bicycles. You look tired. Too much exercise isn't good for you, you know."
The girls laughed.
"Come on now, tell us your names."
"My name's Barbara. Hers is Sharon,"
the little one said. She laughed again.
"Now we're getting someplace," Jerry said to Bill. "Ask him again where they're going."
"Where are you girls going?"
"Barbara.
Where are you going, Barb?"
She laughed.
"No place," she said. "Just down the road."
"Where down the road?"
"Do you want me to tell them?" she said to the other girl.
"I don't care. It doesn't make any difference.
I'm not going to go anyplace with them anyway.
Well, I'm not either, she said. I didn't mean that.
Christ's sake, Jerry said. Where are you going? Bill asked again. Are you going to Painted Rocks?
The girls began laughing.
That's where they're going, Jerry said. Painted Rocks.
He picked up a little speed then and pulled off onto the shoulder ahead of the girls so that they had to come by on his side of the car to get around.
Don't be that way, Jerry said. Come on, get in. We're all introduced. What's the matter anyway?
The girls just laughed as they rode by, and laughed even more when Jerry said,
Come on, we won't bite.
How do we know?
The little one called back over her shoulder.
Take my word for it, sister, Jerry said under his breath.
The brunette glanced back, caught Jerry's eyes, and looked away with a frown. Jerry pulled back onto the highway, dirt and rocks spurting from under the rear tires.
We'll be seeing you, Bill called as they sped by.
It's in the bag, Jerry said. See the look that bitch gave me? I tell you, we got it made.
I don't know, Bill said. Maybe we should cut for home.
No, we got it made. Just take my word for it.
He pulled off the road under some trees when they came to Painted Rocks. The highway forked here, one road going on to Yakima, the other, the main highway, heading for Natchez, Enumclaw, the Chinook Pass, Seattle. 100 yards off the road was a high-sloping black mound of rock, part of a low range of hills honeycombed with footpaths and small caves, with a sprinkling of Indian sign painting here and there on several of the cave walls. The cliff side of the rock, facing the highway, carried announcements and warnings like Natchez 67, Gleed Wildcats, Jesus Saves, Beat Yakima, flat, irregular letters for the most part, in red or white paint. They sat in the car smoking cigarettes, watching the highway and listening to the intermittent tat-tat of a woodpecker back in the trees. A few mosquitoes flew into the car and hovered over their hands and arms. Jerry tried to pick up something on the radio and rapped the dashboard sharply.
Wish we had another beer now. Damn, I sure could go for a beer.
Yeah,
Bill said. He looked at his watch.
Almost 6, Jerry. How much longer are we going to wait?
Christ, they'll be along any minute. They'll have to stop when they get where they're going, won't they? I'll bet $3, all I got, they'll be here in 2 or 3 minutes.
He grinned at Bill and bumped his knee. Then he began to tap the head of the gear shift. When the girls came into view, they were on the opposite side of the highway, facing the traffic. Jerry and Bill got out of the car and leaned against the front fender, waiting. When the girls turned off the shoulder into the trees, they saw the men and began to pedal faster. The little one was laughing as she raised up from the seat to push harder.
Remember, Jerry said, starting away from the car, I'll take the brunette, you take the little one.
Bill stopped.
What are we going to do?
Man, we'd better be careful. Hell, we're just having some fun. We'll get them to stop and talk a while, that's all. Who cares? They aren't going to say anything. They're having fun. They like to be paid attention to.
They began sauntering over to the cliff. The girls dropped their bicycles and commenced running up one of the paths. They disappeared around a corner and then reappeared again, a little higher up, where they stopped and looked down.
What are you guys following us for?
The brunette called down.
Huh? What do you want?
Jerry didn't answer, just started up the path.
Let's run,
Barbara said, still laughing and a little out of breath.
Come on.
They turned and started going up the path at a trot. Jerry and Bill climbed at a walking pace. Bill was smoking a cigarette, stopping every 10 feet or so to get a good inhale. He was beginning to wish he were home. It was still warm and clear, but shadows from the overhead rocks and trees were starting to lengthen out over the trail in front of them. Just as the path turned, he looked back and caught a last glimpse of the car. He hadn't realized they were so high.
Come on, Jerry snapped. Can't you keep up?
I'm coming, Bill said.
You go right, I'll go straight on. We'll cut him off.
Bill angled to the right. He kept climbing. He stopped once and sat down to catch his breath. He couldn't see the car nor the highway.
Over on his left, he could see a strip of the Natchez River, the size of a ribbon, sparkling beside a stand of miniature white spruce.
To the right, he could look down the valley and see the apple and pear orchards neatly laid out against the ridge, and on down the sides of the ridge into the valley, with here and there a house or the sun gleam of an automobile moving on one of the little roads. It was very still and quiet. After a minute, he got up, wiped his hands on his pants, and began following the trail again. He went higher, and then the path began to drop, turning left toward the valley. When he came around a bend, he saw the two girls crouched behind an outcrop of rock, looking down over another path. He stopped, tried casually to light a cigarette, but noticed with a little shock his trembling fingers, and then began to walk toward the girls as nonchalantly as he could. When they heard a rock turn under his foot, they jerked around, saw him, and jumped up, the little ones squealing.
"Come on, wait a minute. Let's sit down and talk this over. I'm tired of walking. Hey!"
Jerry, hearing the voices, came jogging up the path into sight.
"Wait, goddammit!"
He tried to cut them off, and they broke in another direction, the little ones squealing and laughing, both of them running barefoot across the shale and dirt in front of Bill. Bill wondered where they'd left their shoes. He moved to the right. The little one turned sharply and cut up the hill. The brunette whirled, paused, and then took off down a path that led toward the valley, along the side of the hill. Jerry went after her. Bill looked at his watch and then sat down on a rock, took off his dark glasses, and looked again at the sky. The brunette kept running, hopping, until she came to one of the caves, a large overhang of rock with the interior hidden in the shadows. She climbed in as far as she could, sat down, and dropped her head, breathing hard. In a minute or two, she heard him coming down the path. He stopped when he came to the overhang. She held her breath. He picked up a piece of shale, sailed it back into the dark. It whacked against the wall just over her head.
"Hey, what do you want to do? Put my eye out? Quit throwing rocks, you damn jerk."
"Thought you might be hiding out in there. Come out with your hands up or I'm coming in for you."
"Wait a minute," she said.
He jumped up onto a little ledge under the rock and peered into the dark.
"What do you want?" she said. "Why don't you leave us alone?"
"Well," he said, looking at her, letting his eyes move slowly over her body. "Why don't you stop running and we will?"
She came up close to him, and then, with a darting movement, tried to slip by, but he put his hand out to the wall, blocking her way. He grinned. She grinned, then bit her lip and tried to go by on the other side.
"You know you're cute when you smile."
He tried to grab her around the waist, but she turned, slipped away from him.
"Come on! Stop it! Let me out of here!"
He moved in front of her again, touched her breast with his fingers. She slapped his hand down, and he grabbed her breast hard.
"Oh," she said, "you're hurting me. Please, please, you're hurting me."
He relaxed his grip, but didn't let go.
"All right," he said. "I'm not going to hurt you."
Then he let go. She pushed him off balance and jumped past onto the path running downhill.
"God damn you," he yelled. "Come back here."
She took a path to the right that began to climb again. He slipped on some bunch grass, fell, scrambled up, and started running again. Then she turned into a narrow defile 100 feet long, with light and a view of the valley at the other end. She ran, her bare feet smacking the rock and echoing to him above his own hoarse breathing. At the end, she turned and yelled,
"Leave me alone!"
her voice breaking. He saved his breath. She turned and ducked out of sight. When he got to the end, he looked up over his shoulder and saw her climbing steadily on her hands and knees. They were on the valley side, and she was climbing towards the top of a knoll. He knew if she made it, he'd probably lose her. He couldn't go much farther. He put everything he had into it, scrabbling up the side, using rocks and bushes for handholds, his heart pounding and his breath coming in sharp, cutting gasps. Just as she reached the top, he grabbed her ankle and they crawled onto the little plateau at the same time.
"Damn you," he sobbed.
He still had her ankle when she kicked him as hard as she could in the head with her other foot, jarred him so that his ear rang and lights flashed behind his eyes. Son of a bitch, you. His eyes streaming water. He threw himself down over her legs and grabbed her by the arms. She kept trying to bring her knees up, but he turned slightly, kept her pinned down. They lay like for a while, gasping. The girl's eyes were large and rolling with fear. She kept turning her head from side to side and biting her lips. Listen, I'll let you go. You want me to let you go? She nodded quickly. Okay, I will. First I want it, though. Understand? Without any trouble. Okay? She lay without speaking. Okay? Okay, I said. He shook her. After a moment, she nodded. Okay. Okay. He turned loose her arms and raised up, began fumbling with her shorts, trying to unzip them and slide them over her hips. She moved quickly and caught him on the ear with a clenched fist, rolling to the side in the same motion. He lunged after her. She was yelling now. He jumped onto her back and drove her face into the ground. He held onto the nape of her neck. In a minute, when she stopped struggling, he began slipping her shorts down. He stood up, turned his back to her, and began brushing his clothes. When he looked at her again, she was sitting up, staring at the scuffed ground and rubbing a few strands of hair against her forehead. You going to tell anybody? She did not speak. He wet his lips. I wish you wouldn't. She leaned forward and began to cry, quietly, holding the back of her hand against her face. Jerry tried to light a cigarette, but dropped the matches and started to walk off without picking them up. Then he stopped and looked back. For a minute, he couldn't understand what he was doing there, or who this girl was. He glanced uneasily across the valley, the sun just starting to sink into the hills. He felt a slight breeze against his face. The valley was being tipped in with the dark, ground-covering shadows of ridges, rocks, trees. He looked at the girl again. I said I wish you wouldn't say anything. Jesus, I'm sorry, I really am.
Just go away.
He came closer. She started to get up. He stepped forward quickly and hit her on the side of the head with his fist, just as she got to one knee. She fell back with a scream. When she tried to get to her feet again, he picked up a rock and slammed it into her face. He actually heard her teeth and bones crack, and blood came out between her lips. He dropped the rock. She went down heavily, and he crouched over her. When she began moving, he picked up the rock and hit her again, not very hard this time, but on the back of the head. Then he dropped the rock and touched her shoulder. He began to shake her, and after a minute he turned her over. Her eyes were open, glassy, and she began turning her head slowly from side to side, rolling her tongue thickly in her mouth as she tried to spit out blood and splinters of teeth. As she moved her head slightly from side to side, her eyes kept focusing on him, then slipping off. He got up and walked a few feet, then came back. She was trying to sit up. He knelt, put his hands on her shoulders, and tried to make her lie down again. But his hands slipped to her throat, and he began to choke her. He couldn't go through with it, though, just enough so that when he released his hands, her breath came scraping hysterically up her windpipe. She sank back, and he stood up. Then he bent over and worked loose from the ground a big rock. Loose dirt fell from the bottom of the rock as he raised it up even with his eyes and then over his head. Then he dropped it on the girl's face. It sounded like a slap. He picked up the rock again, trying not to look at her, and dropped it once more. Then he picked up the rock again. Bill made his way through the defile. It was very late now, almost evening. He saw where somebody had gone up the hill, turned and retraced his steps to go a different, easier way. He'd caught up with the little one, Barbara, but that was all. He hadn't tried to kiss her, much less anything else. He honestly just hadn't felt like it. Anyway, he was afraid. Maybe she was willing, maybe she wasn't. But he had too much at stake to take a chance. She was down at the bicycles now, waiting for her friend. No, he just wanted to round up Jerry, get back before it got any later. He knew he was going to catch hell from Linda, and she was probably worried sick besides. It was too late. They should have been back hours ago. He was very nervous and sprinted the last few feet up the hill, onto the little plateau. He saw them both at the same time, Jerry standing to the other side of the girl, holding the rock. Bill felt himself shrinking, becoming thin and weightless. At the same time, he had the sensation of standing against a heavy wind that was cuffing his ears. He wanted to break loose and run, but something was moving towards him. The shadows of the rocks, as the shape came across them, seemed to move with the shape and under it. The ground seemed to have shifted in the odd-angled light. He thought unreasonably of the two bicycles waiting at the bottom of the hill near the car, as though taking one away would change all this, make the girl stop happening to him in that moment he had topped the hill. But Jerry was standing now in front of him, slung loosely in his clothes as though the bones had gone out of him. Bill felt the awful closeness of their two bodies, less than an arm's length between. Then the head came down on Bill's shoulder. He raised his hand, and as if the distance now separating them deserved at least this, he began to pat, to stroke the other, while his own tears broke. If it please you. Edith Packer had the tape cassette cord plugged into her ear and was smoking one of his cigarettes. The TV played without any volume as she sat on the sofa with her legs tucked under her and turned to the pages of a news magazine. James Packer came out of the guest room, which he'd fixed up as an office. He was wearing his nylon windbreaker and looked surprised when he saw her, and then disappointed. She saw him and took the cord from her ear. She put the cigarette in the ashtray and wiggled the toes of one stockinged foot at him.
Bingo, he said. Are we going to play bingo tonight or not? We're going to be late, Edith.
I'm going, she said. Sure. I guess I got carried away.
She liked classical music and he didn't. He was a retired accountant, but he did tax returns for some old clients and he'd been working tonight.